It's Sunday morning, time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio, and hope that you're going to have a wonderful rest of your weekend as we move into the holiday season. And of course, this morning is the last day of the gun deer season. So if you are headed out to the woods or fields of Illinois this morning, be careful. Make sure that if you're in a tree stand or any kind of stand that you strap yourself in, the number one cause of hunting accidents is individuals falling out of their deer stand or tree stand. So please be very careful when you do that. This morning, we got a great show. My guest is Kerry Luft, who has been on the air numerous times before. He's one of the leading spokesmen for not only the outdoor industry, but really one of the top communicators in the country when it comes to issues on the outdoors. So, Kerry, with that glowing introduction, good morning, and thank you for being with us.
Always happy to be here, Charlie. Thank you.
And Kerry is also the director of the Center for Conservation Leadership, a newly formed entity that is working on economic efficiencies and conservation. So congratulations for that as well, Kerry.
I appreciate it, Charlie. It's gratifying work, and I'm happy to be doing it.
So let's start off this morning. For those of you joining us, all week long, Kerry, we've been talking about the World Climate Change Summit in Paris. There's been a lot on the news about it. The president's been interviewed. Some individuals who would like to be president have said some not so flattering things about the amount of attention being paid to global climate change, specifically at this time when there are some issues on the world's table that appear to be, let's put it this way, more immediate. So let me ask you, Kerry, as a longtime journalist and someone who for the Chicago Tribune covered foreign affairs and was the foreign editor for a period of time, what do you make of the discussion on climate change, and how is it or is it relevant to the future of hunting and fishing?
Well, Charlie, I think it's absolutely relevant setting aside the debate about whether what role man plays or doesn't play in climate change, we're definitely seeing changes in things like sea levels. You know, my home state of Louisiana is definitely threatened not only by the coastal erosion caused by the oil exploration and gas exploration in the Louisiana marsh, but also by rising sea levels, to the point that one of the premier fisheries in this hemisphere, as well as probably the number one overwintering spot for waterfowl in the North American continent, is at risk. Waters are lapping higher and higher every year at New Orleans's doorstep. On top of that, as you and I have both seen over the years, migration patterns have changed as winters have gotten warmer or colder, as depending on where you are. Certainly, climate change and the long-term effects of what that does for wildlife and wildlife habitat is of vital importance and concern to sportsmen and sportswomen everywhere.
So, obviously, without a healthy environment, not only do we not have good fisheries, not only to feed the world, but also for sport fishing, and certainly we don't have outdoor recreation or outdoor wildlife viewing of anywhere near the magnitude that we have. I guess, Kerry, a question, and you've traveled the globe, literally, as you've been to developing countries, quite honestly, how high on their list is the discussion of climate change when it comes to their future? If you had to, you know, put it on some kind of a rating as to where it stands versus maybe how high it is on the list of, say, the United States.
It's low, Charlie, and there's good reason for that. I mean, you know, we in the developed world speak from a standpoint of relative economic wealth, regardless of what our economy is doing at the time. One of the most enlightening conversations I ever had was when I was a foreign correspondent in Brazil, and I was speaking to a very urbane Brazilian executive who had been educated in the United States and, you know, today is a great volunteer with conservation organizations in South America. And so he understands the concerns about the environment. And one of the people I was with on that day said something relatively innocuous. When is Brazil going to stop the exploitation of the Amazonian rainforest? And he bristled and he said, you know, that's easy for you to say. And no one told the United States to stop exploiting its wilderness when it did so during the Industrial Revolution 100 years ago. For many of the world's non-developed countries or developing countries, economic prowess, economic growth is the number one priority, and everything else is competing for number two. The Chinese, who are, you know, some of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases in the world. Well, you know, it's important the new Chinese leadership has signaled a willingness to talk climate change, but this is a change over decades when the Chinese economy was racing pell-mell to keep the world's largest population fed and happy. Currently, another one of the big developing countries that is balking at some of the proposals on the climate change agenda is India. These countries are hesitant to do anything that they think will rein in their economic growth, and economic growth is really important to them.
So we're visiting with Kerry Luft, who is the director of the Center for Conservation Leadership, and we're talking about the World Climate Conference. Kerry, you very succinctly talk about if your people are more concerned with putting food on the table.
Sure.
They are about the future of the climate, then they are not willing to make sacrifices, if you will, for what in many cases, I guess, is the climate's always been changing, Kerry. In this program, and you've been a longtime listener and participant, you know I've never taken a position as to whether we're having global warming or not. I've only taken the position that we should be discussing the issues and let our listeners make up their own minds.
Sure.
But in the context of the world coming together to try to do something about this, how real is it for the United States to be the leader on this from an economic and societal point of view when we have some of the biggest countries, developing nations in the world, developing, who this is not going to be a high priority for?
Well, I mean, I guess the argument for the United States on the side that advocates the United States doing this is sort of like the American exceptionalism argument. If not the United States, then who? The U.S. is still the world's true superpower. And one of the things that some of these developing nations, not so much China and India, but one of the things that, say, Latin American countries are looking for are assurances that they will get financial assistance. And like in many other cases, when you talk about international financial assistance, the piggy bank starts in Washington, D.C. So the advocates for this, for the U.S. participation, are saying the U.S. should be the leader. It should be better. It should be leading the way. However, you know, you make a good point about countries wanting to put food on the table. It, for some of these countries, particularly China, it's even more than that. The Chinese government is deathly afraid of any kind of economic slowdown, because that could lead to societal unrest. And if there's anything the Communist Party of China does not want, is unrest, economic driven or whatever. They are going to do everything in their power to keep that economic engine driving. And if it comes down to a choice between keeping their coal plants burning and really polluting the air, I mean, Charlie, I've been to Beijing and it's been so bad you can't walk outside. Because of the sediment in the air. It's like walking through mud. If they have a choice between doing that or meeting standards and slowing down their economic engine, well, history tells us what they're going to do. They're going to keep the engine drawing.
So that's, Kerry, taking a look back at history, the United States came through, and Europe came through the Industrial Revolution. We burned rivers. Rivers burned because of their huge amount of pollution. The air quality, you look at pictures of New York and Chicago from the turn of the century, that would be the last turn of the century, and you can't see two blocks.
Sure.
It wasn't government, if I remember history correctly, that said we got to fix this. It was the people of the United States that said we have to fix this. So is it going to be different? Take China for an example, heavily, heavily polluted right now. Will the people rise up and say, we don't want to live in this anymore, you, government, have to clean this up? That's what happened in the United States, largely.
I would like to believe that's possible, but remember, China is a totalitarian government. You know, the social unrest or even social dissent is quashed. So I don't think the parallel is quite accurate, although I wish it could be. The scale of the pollution there And frankly, there is a bit of a groundswell against it, but the government really does quash dissent, and there's no apparatus for grassroots-driven reform in countries like China. It just doesn't happen. So I'm rather pessimistic on that front. India, yes, perhaps. But again, people in India, people in these very poor countries, they're more worried about where their food's coming from, not whether the pollution is ruining their rivers and streams and air.
So in a way, Kerry, is it fair to say they're 100 years behind us? When we were raping and pillaging the land, everything for economic development, turning the Corps of Engineers loose, channelizing all of our rivers, building all these dams, much of which we look back on now and say, we shouldn't have done it. Do these countries have to go through that same evolution to arrive at where we are?
I think they do. I honestly do. It's hard to make the argument. Cripple your economy. You know, if you feel like you're going to cripple your economy to address these pollution issues, I think it's a hard sell, and we're seeing that already. The developing nations are resisting the proposals by the developed nations at this climate change contest. And I am, in some ways, I'm a relativist. That conversation that I related at the beginning of the show about a very sophisticated Brazilian person saying, hey, wait, who is the United States to talk about eradicating its wilderness and eradicating some of its wildlife species? It really hit home with me, and it's something that I've always thought about. It is easy for us in a relatively wealthy, strong society to say what else should be done. Now, having said that and having been to China, yes, I wish they had learned from our example. It is murderous, the pollution there.
So, Kerry, before we go to a break, I'm visiting with Kerry Loft, who is the director of the Center for Conservation Leadership. You're a Louisiana, New Orleanian by native, and we got about a minute before the break. In your lifetime, and you're a young guy, so maybe in your father's lifetime, if you will, has the non-man-made subsidence in the Gulf of in South Louisiana impacted the quality of life? We all know that the oil and gas drilling and channels has led to great saltwater intrusion, etc. But has Louisiana, is it beginning to see any effects of climate change? And that's a subjective question for me, maybe unfair to ask you, but what do you think?
I'm not a scientist, so I can't say this is from the oil and the saltwater intrusion and this is from rising sea levels. But people I trust say the rising sea levels aren't helping. And I can tell you, Charlie, that land that I used to walk on when I was a Boy Scout isn't there anymore. We have talked many times on this program about the coastal erosion of Louisiana. It is an absolute environmental catastrophe and one that doesn't get nearly enough attention, regardless of what the cause of it is.
Well, Kerry, we'll certainly have much more on this in the coming months, because after all, whatever comes out of Paris, I guess is going to have to be ratified by the U.S. Congress, because the president can't spend money that Congress doesn't approve.
There's a question about that. One of the problems with that is that the Congress will have to prove that he's signing a treaty, and that will probably lead to another long and drawn-out fight of whether this is a policy agreement or a treaty, and the presidency has more leeway with the policy argument. So we'll see what happens there.
I guess stay tuned. And by the way, folks, stay tuned. We'll be back with Kerry Loft and more on the Great Outdoor Show in just a moment. Thank you for being with us. This is Charlie Potter, your host on the Outdoor Show, Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN, and first a message from your Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
It's a winter wonderland, and it's your playground if you have the right equipment. Well, the 2015 Chevy Silverado is the key to a winter full of activity. With 12,000 pounds of towing capacity, Silverado can tow your snowmobiles anywhere you want to go. Hunting, ice fishing, Silverado gets 24 miles per gallon on the highway. And if you're hunting for a new truck, there's never been a better time to see your local Chevy dealer. They have leasing experts who can get you more Chevy for less money with a big fix lease. Chevy Silverado is the first and only pickup to to offer 4G LTE Wi-Fi that keeps you connected on the go. It's the longest lasting, most dependable pickup on the road, and that makes it the best choice you can make for off the road. Throw in a 2-year, 24,000-mile free schedule maintenance, and you've got yourself an all-American camping partnership made in heaven. Ask about the Big Fix lease at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer, or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for all the details. Track it down. And oh, by the way, there's no limit.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host. Carrie Luft, my guest this morning, director of the Center for Conservation Leadership. And we're going to have a little bit of levity, Carrie, in the few minutes we have remaining. And it was a very serious, but also, I think, very worthwhile conversation we had on what's taking place in Paris at the World Climate Change Conference. But, Carrie, you were participating in a story that now is becoming known as Mike and the Mouse.
Oh, my.
So for the next couple minutes, will you share with us what it was like to be with Mike and the Mouse, a great outdoor adventure for those who maybe would like to laugh a little?
Well, Charlie, the tale of Mike and the Mouse begins early in the morning before dawn, as most good outdoor stories do. We were riding on an ATV back into a splendid duck marsh, ready to hunt some mallards and teal, when our mutual friend Mike said, "Hey, I think a stick fell down my shirt. Would you please reach down my shirt and dig it out for me?" Now, Charlie, you and I both know that when your hunting buddy asks you a favor, no matter what it is, you try to help him out. So there I was with my arm down to my elbow, down the back of Mike's shirt. And, you know, Charlie, there are many times when I say, "Boy, I wish I had a camera along." That was not one of them. But I couldn't find a stick in Mike's shirt, and we wound up having about a four-hour hunt, just marvelous time. Saw a lot of birds. It was a beautiful morning and to be in a blind. And we headed back to the lodge, and as hunters like to do, we were recapping everything, and all of a sudden, Mike starts pulling off his jersey, and then he pulls off his shirt, and he reaches for his belt buckle, and I'm thinking, boy, this is another time I'm glad there's no cameras around. But then he hauled up his long underwear top, and out fell a mouse. Not just a mouse, a live mouse. And Mike, just that day, had been telling us how terrified he was of mice and how much he hated mice, and one had been burrowing down the back of his shirt for 4 hours while he sat there and blew a duck call, rearranged decoys, handled his Labrador. I tell you, Charlie, I've seen a lot of great performance in the outdoors, but Mike's my new hero. That was something else.
Oh, Carrie, you make me laugh, and I hope many of you enjoy that as well. And one of the things I'd love to do is, if you have an humorous outdoor story, will you email me at WGN, and we'd love to hear about it. And from time to time, we'll maybe have more episodes titled differently, but Mike and the Mouse starts off what I consider to be maybe a little bit of a levity in the Great Outdoor Show. And thank you, Carrie, for bringing that to us. And thank you for being with us this morning, Carrie. And for all of you listening, I'll be back next Sunday morning with more on the Great Outdoors as we move into December and the great holiday season, but also that time when winter rushes to claim the land and there's still time to be in the outdoors before it claims it. Thanks for being with me. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.